Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Well, welcome to Access Utah today. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and shortly to be in the studio with us is Grant Carden, USU's Extension Soil Specialist, and we're going to talk about cover crops. We're going to talk about how to improve the soil in your garden, because in Utah, much of our soils are lacking in especially organic matter. So we hope you'll call into our program. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us a question. Just go to send it to directly at upraccess@gmail.com. You can also tweet us and just go online, and it's #AUGarden. And I hope to hear from you. We're going to change things up here just a little bit. First, you're going to hear Melinda's gardening moment, and then we'll come back and talk to Grant Carden. I guess maybe instead of that, because for whatever reason, Melinda's isn't available, I understand. So we're going to do our latest edition of Wild About Utah.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. You may have heard about the golden eagle nestling that was caught in a recent Utah wildfire. Its nest was totally destroyed, but the little eagle had fallen to the ground and survived. After the fire, he was found by Kent Keller, a volunteer for Utah's Division of Natural Resources. Keller had banded the young eagle just a month before. Since the eagle was dehydrated, his feathers, face, and feet badly burned, Keller obtained a permit from wildlife officials to intervene. Now resting at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Northern Utah, the eagle is recovering rapidly. Even so, it will take a while for the damaged feathers to be replaced by healthy new ones. Phoenix, as he was aptly named, won't learn to fly for at least another year. With this and other fire-related stories in the news, I've been wondering about the fate of animals caught in wildfires. Scientific observations of animal behavior during fire events are rare, but by conducting post-fire surveys and comparing results with unburned areas, some researchers have been able to piece together an idea of who survives, who dies, and who thrives. Obviously, faster and more mobile animals have the advantage. Birds can fly away, and most mammals can outrun the spreading flames. Spring fires, however, can be disastrous, destroying birds who haven't fledged, like Phoenix, or mammals who are still too immature to escape. Fortunately, fires are more frequent in mid to late summer, when the little ones have matured. If a fire moves through an area quickly, without superheating the ground, dormant animals or those hiding in burrows can survive. The surrounding soil provides plenty of insulation. Soil also protects most soil macrofauna and the pupae of many insects. Animals that live their lives totally or partially in the water may not suffer at all during a fire. However, smaller bodies of water, such as streams, can quickly heat up. Oxygen loss is a problem as well. And firefighting chemicals dumped from the air can end up in the water, killing fish, frogs, and other animals. Indirectly, the alteration of habitat by fire can also restructure animal populations. Interestingly, there are quite a lot of animals that benefit from these post-fire habitats. For example, the insect population above ground may plummet during a fire, but then increase above pre-fire levels when the fresh young plants start to grow back. Burned trees are attractive to certain beetles as breeding sites. An increase in beetles is a windfall for the woodpeckers that devour them. Swallows and flycatchers use burned dead trees as perch sites. They survey from on high and then swoop to catch their insect dinner. Seed-eating birds, like Clark's nutcracker, gobble up conifer seeds when cones open in response to fire. Among mammals, ground squirrels, pocket gophers, and deer mice generally increase after severe fires. Even large herbivores, such as pronghorn or deer, may benefit from the increased food and nutrition on recent burns. In turn, predators of these creatures enjoy a bumper crop as well. For images of Phoenix, the recovering golden eagle, and a link to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Northern Utah, go to www.wildaboututah.org. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Welcome again to Access Utah. In studio with me today is Grant Cardin, USU's Extension Soil Specialist, and we're going to talk soils. So please call in with your questions or comments, 800-826-1495, upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. Grant, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Well, I've been out in my garden, and I've often wished, why couldn't I have soil more like I had when I was growing up in Mendon? And then I go back east and I think, why couldn't I have more soil like some places that I'm visiting? So what is it that makes a soil more alkaline or more acid? What makes that up?
What makes that happen? A lot of the different constituents that we have and the effect of the local climate and things like that. So there's certain materials that buffer changes in pH, things like calcium carbonate and other things which buffer it higher to the alkaline side. And then if you're in an environment where you have a lot of weathering potential, like a lot of rainfall, leaching, and things like that happen, then a lot of those kinds of materials dissolve away eventually and leave the soil less buffered to changes in acidity. So you end up getting, like in the eastern United States, more acid soils that don't have a lot of that excess lime and things like that in them. Out here in the West, where things are dry and we don't have a lot of rainfall compared to how much evaporation takes place in the natural environment, those things are left behind. So they tend to build up and then buffer those pHs to higher levels, the calcium carbonate, for instance, and the gypsum and other salts that are in the system.
Now, I never did send any soil samples in when I was growing up in Mendon, but I know I never had to add iron for my raspberries or my strawberries. I mean, they just grew. They did just fine. And I think, if I remember correctly, the pH in certain places in, like, say, Paradise or Avon, they're a little bit higher. Weeksberry Farm has gotten a great location. So why in one location where they get pretty much kind of the same precipitation, are their soils better?
Yeah, in those cases, it's strictly a function of the materials that were there to start with. So you have little pockets of areas that don't have a lot of that limestone material that are there to raise the pH and that kind of stuff. So you start off with a better system. And they tend to be more sandy soils that we find in the benches and little pockets and things like that are more easily leached as well. And so anything that might, you know, land there as dust or brought in with the water or things like that, it's a little bit easier for it to be washed from the system over time. And so there are areas in Utah, especially as you get up in the foothills and the mountains and things like that, where you'll find pockets of more acidic conditions. But for the most part in Utah, we have lots of excess lime materials in our soils that keep the pH up at around 7.5 to 8, which is in that alkaline range.
Well, when you think about it, you go into the mountains, and the mountains are going to get more precipitation.
They are, and they're sandier soils, not a lot of clay buildup in a lot of those, except in pockets where you have low-lying areas. But so they tend to leach more, too, and they lose those what we call evaporites over time. They tend to dissolve and are washed away down to lower depths, which is us out here in the valleys.
And in Mendon, I'm guessing it's because I live down in town, and there are a lot of springs in town, and there's this beautiful sandy loam. So again, it's leaching through.
Right. And you probably didn't start with a lot of that lime material in those soils. It was probably more the sandstone and granite from the local mountains and things that built up in coarser textures and allowed that to flow more freely. Yeah.
So the calcium carbonate is coming from what?
Calcium carbonate is dissolved limestone that's reprecipitated back in our soils. And so it comes in with the water. It's dissolved in the water. It comes in with the dust that blows in across, from the West Desert and those kinds of things, and settles in our soils. And over time, because we just don't have a lot of water flushing through them, it builds up. And it's been building up over, eons of geologic time in this area. So you've got 10, 15, up to 30. We've seen higher than 30% in some cases calcium carbonate in our soils.
So how long would it take to flush through the soil? If all of a sudden we started getting 30 and 40 inches of water a year.
It would still take a long time. The material, calcium carbonate itself in our soils, is not real soluble. So the water would not have to be in larger quantities, but also a little bit more acidic to be able to dissolve that material and then wash it away. If we're trying to adjust pH in a soil with excess lime or excess calcium carbonate, it's pretty difficult because you have to add almost pound for pound, concentrated acids in order to accomplish the dissolving of that material. And then you've got to then wash all that away. So it's really difficult. When you're looking at 1% calcium carbonate by weight in the top foot of an acre of land, say, that's about 40,000 pounds of calcium carbonate. So, when you're talking about a pound-for-pound need, if we're in soils that are, 10, 15, 20% calcium carbonate, that's a lot of material.
A lot. Yeah. So I know at Weeksbury Farm, I went out and was taking a look at their operations with the Berry Growers Association several years ago. And the soil is so yellow because they've added so much sulfur. I mean, they are growing blueberries there.
They are, yeah.
And they found some way to make it profitable, but it was yellow. They had so much sulfur on the soil.
Well, I've consulted quite a bit with Merv over the years and not giving away his trade secrets. He starts off with a much better condition than most of us do in terms of soil pH, but he still has to, like you say, battle it quite a bit because you've got carbonates in the soils around that want to make their way into his beds, and you've got calcium carbonate dissolved in the irrigation water that he's using, so he's fighting that as well. And so it really is a constant battle for him to keep that pH low enough to be able to grow those kinds of things. When people ask me about, well, what about us growing blueberries here? it's unless you're going to containerize it and, use an organic potting mix type of thing that starts off acidic and then really be careful about your water and treat your water to try to reduce the dissolved calcium carbonate in the water, then you're always going to be in a really uphill battle.
So would you have to use bottled water in order if you did put a blueberry plant in a container?
You can treat the water with acids in order to drive off that calcium carbonate a little bit, but neutralize that so that it helps keep that water from building up that pH again back in the potting medium over time. But, that's an expensive and fairly unpleasant. Yeah, it's a fairly unpleasant proposition for people to handle acids and things like that. It's not, there's risks associated with that health-wise and things like that too. So, bottled water would be a rather expensive proposition for irrigation purposes. So, a lot of people try and a lot of people succeed on, keeping the pHs down low enough to get a crop out of it, but they never really thrive in these higher pH soils.
So do you just kind of shake your head when you walk into a store and you see rhododendrons for sale or blueberries for sale?
Well, as long as, people are aware that they're going to struggle with those kinds of plants that are acid environment loving type plant materials, then, I don't have any problem with somebody trying to sell them. Realize that you're never going to develop the color in a rhododendron or azalea or other things like that that you would see elsewhere because of the acidic conditions. But, and And a lot of materials are sold as soil acidifiers and things like that. And the claims for those are true in the sense that they do produce acid. But when you're looking at the problem of scale, like we just talked about, trying to dissolve all of that material away first before you can lower the pH, it's pretty difficult to add enough of those materials to really make a big difference.
So generally, the further east you go from Denver, are they pretty alkaline?
They're still really alkaline, yeah. In fact, until you get into, Nebraska and things like that, where you start really getting into like the 30-inch rainfall levels and things like that or more, you don't really see the acidic conditions develop as much. So, you know, in the western Great Plains on through the western U.S., you see increasingly more and more of these alkaline soils that we deal with because of the dry environments where those materials build up over time.
Okay, so let me ask this question. Is acid always better? In other words, if you live in an area with acid soils, what are they wishing that they could grow that they can't?
Well, they always battle on the opposite side of things. The dissolving of aluminum in their soils in acid conditions, which in too high a quantities is toxic to most plant materials. And so, you know, you've got them on the other side that are constantly calculating things like lime requirement to raise their pHs. They want to get powdered limestone and add it to their soils to try to balance the pH a little bit in those so that they have good success. Because otherwise, if they let it get down too acidic, you know, you start releasing elements from the soils that are naturally there but are more dissolved in those conditions and cause some plant toxicity. So they've got their share of battles to wage as well in an acidic condition.
So what areas of the country would you say are really acidic?
Oh, the southeast and the northeast and some pockets in the Great Lakes area where they have boggy soils and things like that, where they just have a lot of, you know, high acidic or high acid or low pH conditions. So, you'll find them scattered all through the Midwest, upper Midwest, the Northeast, the Southeast, where you have fairly acidic conditions. And you're talking about rainfall levels there, the 30 to 50, you know, inches. We go gaga over the fact that we get, you know, an inch of rain a month or something in a monsoon period. We're pretty excited about that.
But. Well, so now look at the Olympic Peninsula. I mean, it's getting, I think in some areas, over 100 inches of rain. Is it just that the plants have adapted to those particular soil conditions?
Yeah, you've got, you know, what we call just acid-loving plants there. So they've adapted over time. And if you look at our areas, we have a lot of really well-adapted native plants to high pH conditions, the wheatgrasses and the sage and the greasewoods. And they're not your most desirable plants, you know, in terms of, you know, aesthetics a lot of times in some people's minds. But they are, just like you find elsewhere, adapted to those conditions. And there's plants there in the acid areas too. So
it seems that the higher acid can support the larger foliage type plants, where the more alkaline usually see they're in dry, like you said, the drier conditions. They have smaller leaves, they're smaller plants. And
You've got a couple of things working against you in these drier environments. Number one is the water availability. You can't grow a plant without water to start with, and so they tend to be a little bit more stunted in that case. And then you have what we've been talking about here, the pH conditions, which the real problem with the alkaline pHs is the mobility and solubility of the trace nutrient elements, things like the zinc and the iron and the phosphorus and other things that become immobilized and insoluble in higher pH conditions. And so the plants just struggle to get those nutrients in a lot of those things. And we have to manage for that as best we can.
Are there any plants that those who live in those higher acidic soils can't grow that we can? I mean, we can't grow blueberries very well, but...
Yeah. Most plants are adapted to a fairly wide range of pHs and, you know, crop plants and other things like that. But you would find some of our native trees around here, some of the things like box elder and those that have adapted it to these higher pH conditions wouldn't do nearly as well in acidic soils either. But, you know, it's really a nutrient availability issue with a lot of those. And those tend, you know, like the blueberries and some of the raspberry varieties and the azaleas and things like that you're talking about tend to be fairly inefficient in the uptake of the micronutrients. And that's why we see the problems with them here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was attending a Cub Scout day camp last Friday. And in one of the sections where they were talking about, I think they were the Weebles were trying to earn their forestry pin. And I realized that most of these day camps are staffed by 15, 16, 17-year-olds. But for the most part, they did pretty good. But in the forestry, they were going through and talking about some of the plants in the forest. And he pointed to this tree. So now this is a sugar maple. I pulled the Weeblos aside in our pack and said, that's not a sugar maple because sugar maples won't grow here.
No, yeah.
Partly because of...
Because of the situation.
The
water levels and the iron deficiencies and things like that that they'll find. People do try to grow them in you know, ornamental horticultural plantings and things in and around landscapes. And that's where you'll see like the silver maples and other things really suffering because of that nutrient deficiency battle that is waged in our alkaline soils.
Well, I told him, I said, well, that one's a Rocky Mountain big-tooth maple. It is a maple, but it's not the right kind. Well, now, let's talk about a couple, and I don't know if you feel comfortable with this, a couple of the plants that you see quite a bit that maybe would not be worth putting in. You mentioned silver maple.
Right.
Now, I've seen some good-sized silver maples, so they must have grown well at one point, but it just seems lately I've been seeing all different sizes are just not doing well. Maybe that was last year.
And when they get to a certain size, too, it's a little more difficult for them to take up enough and translocate enough of those micronutrients to handle the size of the tree. So they can outgrow their ability to, you know, to support themselves sometimes. And you'll see that in some of the older trees. And then they get a little bit more inefficient at uptake, too, over time as they age. And so you will in some of the older trees start to see some of that develop. And I don't know, you know, all of the plant materials being a soils guy, but we've got a number of extension publications on the suitability of, you know, trees and shrubs and other ornamental horticultural plants for salty soils and for higher pH conditions. And Mike Coons and the Extension Forestry guys, you know, they developed the tree selector software that you can, you know, log into online and you can get a CD of and those kinds of things, which help you to categorize that. You can say, you know, what are the pH ranges that these do best, and it'll give you a selection of trees and shrubs that do that. And so, you know, I would recommend folks jump in there and take a look at some of those resources on that.
Well, and you would think that in the last couple of years, you know, not this year, but the last two springs where we actually had more precipitation, that some of these more marginal trees would do better, but it actually exacerbated the situation.
Yeah, because they got water, they're excited, they start that flush of growth, and then there's that nutrient uptake problem again. And so we see it in crop plants too. I mean, they get growing, they get vigorous, they outgrow sometimes the supply of the nutrient that's there, and you begin to see some problems with it. Then, you know, sometimes people see nutrient deficiencies in plants around here that we begin to ascribe to maybe soil problems or the lack of the nutrient or things like that, when in reality it may be a disease pressure or winter kill or other things, age in the plant as well. And so you got to make sure that you rule out a lot of those other pressures that can cause an apparent nutrient deficiency symptom in the plant.
Well, one thing, when we had you on last year, I don't think we got to talk a lot about it. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about how to submit a soil sample and what you can request or what should you request in the sample. I'd like to invite our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question or comment, it's 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us a question at #AUGarden. So whether you're in an older home or have just moved into a new home, I would recommend getting a soil sample. Now, why don't you discuss how to submit a soil sample?
Well, with homeowners in particular, we encourage them to, you know, kind of map out their yard and decide what areas they're going to essentially treat separately. So, you've got your vegetable garden area that you're probably going to manage a little bit differently than you're going to manage your turf area. You have flower boxes that you're going to manage probably different than you would your turf area. And there may be areas where they have a concentration of trees and other things that they may think about calling that a separate zone as well. So wherever you have these different zones in your yard, we recommend you take separate samples from each of those, because the plants that are growing there, the things that you're doing in terms of amending the soils and working the soils and things like that are going to be a little bit different there. And so it'd be good to have good information for each one of those to guide management. In taking the actual physical sample, we recommend that you take a random pattern of selection of soil materials from the area.
So how far or wide? I mean, should I do a soil sample for the backyard as well as a soil sample for the front yard? Or
if it's all turf, you're not going to manage it any differently. So you wouldn't necessarily take it different from the backyard to the front yard unless you know that you have very different soils in the front yard compared to the backyard. And that may happen with some folks where they've got, you know, a gravelly or sandy area in the back and more clay area in the front. And so in those cases, if you know you've got a really big difference in soil type, you might want to take a separate sample in those two areas. But typically, you're not going to manage your lawn from the front to the back any differently. So getting a good physical average of the whole area is really better in terms of management. But the idea really is to do just that, is to take a physical average of soil conditions that are there. And for most plantings, except for the deepest rooted trees, we're looking at the top foot of soil really is the kind of the management zone we're going to take soil from to target our nutrient management program. So in an area the size of most home yards, you're looking at, you know, a third to maybe a quarter acre or something like that. You can represent the turf area with five or six samples from that in a random pattern, then mixed together, composited as we call it, and then take a subsample of that and send it into the laboratory. So you're, by compositing, you're forming a physical average of conditions for the area.
So would you do one if you've got a vegetable garden versus a flower garden versus the turf, would you do a sample for each of those areas?
For each of those areas, yeah, that would be the best. Because then what we're going to ask you at the laboratory is what you're planning on doing with that soil. Are you going to be growing turf? Are you going to be growing garden vegetables? Are you going to be growing flowers? And as much information as you can give us about what you're planning to do on that soil, we can interpret the test results appropriately. So we can say you're going to need X amount of nutrient, you know, in those settings. And it's going to be different for the turf than it will be for the vegetable garden. So as much information as you can provide us about what you're planning to do management-wise on that area, the better our interpretations of the soil test results will be for you and the recommendations that come from that.
How does the soil near the foundation of a building affect how the profile? And then how does the soil from especially a new construction, because I've seen new homes being built and all that subsoil coming out
is now surface soil.
And it's now surface soil, and it's not going to produce anything, and or it's stripped off and taken away and sold elsewhere. I mean, that's like raping the landscape. It just irritates me to no end to see that taken off.
Well, yeah, we caution people to watch for that, especially if they're doing a custom build. I mean, that's their lot, it's their topsoil. Make sure you instruct, you know, your contractors to stockpile that and keep it, because you're going to want it replaced as best it can be, you know, back in the right places, and to try to give the soil as much an opportunity to function the way it should as possible. But a lot of people don't have that option. You know, They're just not aware of it. They're in attractive homes or something like that where it's a cut and fill and it's been brought in from other places, and they end up with some fairly poorly developed soils. There's not a lot of structure in them, not a lot of organic matter in them. They tend to be sometimes, you know, the material that comes out of the basement dig, and so it's higher in pH and clay and other things sometimes in those conditions. So, yeah, you have to deal with those. So it's really important, especially, like you say, in new construction areas, that you get a good soil sample to know where you're starting from, because it, you know, it's going to be critical to get that kickstart to begin developing the structure in the soil and the organic matter levels, build them back up and provide for the immediate needs of the plants you're trying to put in there to help you accomplish that.
Now, each of the counties in Utah, and I would say most of surrounding states as well, have their own extension offices where you can take your soil sample, or you can even go in and pick up the little kit that gives you the instructions on how to do it. Right. So is that where you would take the soil sample back to, or
yes,
do you mail it directly?
Well, you can mail it directly either way. In fact, with the way the postal services change things over time, we used to have these little self-addressed boxes, you know, that were made available. There's still a few of those out there, but the address has changed for the laboratory. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
I'm not. So I've got one of those boxes.
Yeah, the old Ag Science building on campus where the soil testing lab is no longer. It's completely gone. It's a big hole in the ground right now. So the soil testing laboratory was moved out onto 800 East here in Logan, just off the hill from Romney Stadium there on in what used to be the Animal Nutrition Research Laboratory, the Skaggs Laboratory, right there on 8th East. And so if you get on the website, www.usual.usu.edu, which stands for USU Analytical Laboratories, and you can do a search on USU's main website, too, for the analytical laboratories. It'll give you all the details of the new address and things like that. And the counties are aware of that change. And so if you take it into the counties, they'll make sure they get it in the right spot. But getting back to those little boxes, the cost of mailing those versus putting it in a flat rate box, you know, at the post office and mailing it to us is pennies difference now. And so we recommend folks just to go grab one of these little flat rate boxes, you know, and you can send it directly to us. Or you can take it into the county, and the county agents will typically have people coming back and forth to campus, or one of us, as we go out as a specialist to make a presentation in an area, they'll have us bring them back to campus and deliver them to the laboratory too. And so there's a lot of that you can do. So taking it into the county office or mailing it directly to the USU Analytical Laboratories, either way, it'll get here in good shape in a reasonable time, and you'll get the information that you need from it. And on that website, there too, are the instructions for taking a good soil sample, the forms that you fill out that give us the information we talked about, you know, where did the soil come from, what are you planning on doing with it, and so forth, to help us craft the recommendations for your soil specifically to what you're planning on doing.
And when you're getting the soil, do you usually go down a little bit, or do you do it from the surface? Where do you collect
it? The top 12 inches typically in a turf or garden or flower box area is fine. So you can also check out from the counties if you go there first. Most of them have soil coring implements that you can check out free of charge, take it home, poke holes in the ground, pull the soil out, and collect it that way. It's a lot easier than trying to do it with a shovel in the middle of your lawn, for instance. You've got to typically use a coring device there to minimize the disruption to the system.
But, well, tell me then, what's the cost? What are you looking at? Because I think the last time I looked, it was fairly inexpensive for a real basic test.
Yeah. The routine soil test that gives you pH that we've been talking a lot about previously, the salinity level, the salt content of the soil, the soil texture, and the phosphorus and potassium nutrient levels in the soil cost currently $14. I think it's been a number of years since that price was raised, and I think that's going up a little bit, but not terribly much here in the next little while. But right now, currently, it's $14 a sample. And so a $14 sample represents essentially all of your turf area or all of your vegetable garden. So if you submitted three, for instance, from the flower garden, the vegetable garden, and the turf, you'd have, you know, $14 each to have those analyzed and interpreted.
Are there any tests in addition to those that you might recommend adding?
There's a number of them. I mean, if you've had repeated problems with, you know, iron deficiency, for instance, in plants and things like that, you may want to have, iron added to that. And all of those tests you can add. There's every element that you want to analyze for, we can do at the laboratory. And so we don't do down there things like petroleum distillates and hydrocarbons and things like that. You have to send those to labs that handle that organic chemistry. But for all the inorganic elements, the nutrient elements and things like that that we deal with, then we can do that all here at the analytical lab. So
if you wanted to do an analysis on everything that you guys do, how much would that cost for a sample?
Oh, well, we do a number of things that we have packages, and they're listed on the order form there. If you went as far to say, I want a complete analysis, which gives you the routine plus all of the micronutrients and a lot of the metals and things like that, a 40-element scan, I think the cost currently is about $50 a sample. So, you know.
And that's still pretty inexpensive,
it's still
considering
pretty inexpensive.
How much you could spend on that soil that you really don't need to.
Right. So. And you really wouldn't want to go that level unless the routine tells you that you've got potential for problems like that and you've routinely seen the deficiencies in your yard. You might want to have, additional analysis for iron and zinc and some of these others. But, it steps up and it grades up, and there's a kind of a menu there of the different tests that we can perform on soils right up, like I said, to the Cadillac complete analysis kind of thing on that. So,
well, you're listening to Access Utah. Grant Cardin is USU's Soils Extension Specialist. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden. And you can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. I've always been curious, do foundations change the soil in any way? In other words, if you've got plants growing up against a cement foundation, for instance, is that going to change how they can uptake or the soil itself?
It depends on what your soil conditions are to start with. I mean, if we've got soils that are really high in lime materials, growing next to concrete, which is lime, it's been hardened into an insoluble form. It doesn't have that much effect on what's going on, but there are those that will say, if you've built up a really nice flower bed with lots of organic material and you're trying to keep the pH a little bit lower in those areas and things like that, then as you get closer and closer to the foundation, there's some of that, leaching of that calcium carbonate into the soil, which will raise the pH really close back into the alkaline condition, and then you might see in areas closer to the foundation some of that same problem we talked about before with the higher pH conditions. So, yeah, there's a little bit of that that goes on, but typically that's fairly inert. Some of the things that happen there are edge effects with the way the water flows and how much water is stored and whether or not the roots get bound, against or within the confines of the foundation and things like that. So you got to watch out for some of that. But most of the time, chemically speaking, our soils are just as high in calcium carbonate as the concrete is, and you really won't see that much differential. Yeah,
I've heard from some people that they told me, "Oh, yes, if you add some pine needles or something like that, that changes the pH." And I've always thought, well, maybe microscopically, it just a teeny little amount, but not enough.
Well, there's no getting around the fact that the decomposition of those materials does produce acid. But that acid is so quickly consumed when you have these buffering materials that are naturally there at high levels that you don't really see that mass effect in the soils. You do, like you say, you'll see it in very localized areas over very short periods of time. And that's why a lot of times we still encourage some of the addition of some of these amendments, because they will cause temporary, localized changes in pH that can help mobilize some of the micronutrients in what we call the rhizosphere, right around the root of the plant and things like that, as it works in concert with the plant as exudates and things like that that come out of the root tissues themselves and kind of then help modify that environment enough to get a little extra iron or get a little extra zinc out of the soil. So
one of the major problems that we typically have is iron chlorosis. Plants just can't, certain plants can't uptake the iron because it's bound up by the alkalinity in the soil. So you've got all different ways to try to rectify that, and typically I'm seeing that in my raspberries and my strawberries. I mean, they just wouldn't be able to grow without doing something with the soil. So do you typically put on a fuller spray, or do you put it in the soil? I would think soil is probably the best way to do it over the long term.
Over the long term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Foliar spray, it's topical. It's there immediately, but then there's nothing there to
right.
Set
and it doesn't really get stored in the plant over time. It'll lose its leaves, and it loses then the nutrient and things, which will recycle back in the soil if you leave it in place. But over time, but then again, it's probably going to end up in a fairly insoluble compound pretty quickly at the high pH. So modification of the soil as best we can with some of the additives that we have available to us for iron. You've got just the mineral forms. Iron sulfate is probably the most common of those. It's a soluble iron source that's available as a fertilizer material at nurseries and garden stores and other things around. And
it's not chelated though, right?
No, it's not. That's just the straight mineral salt of iron essentially there that you're able to put on, and it's fairly soluble. And
so would iron sulfate be good for the long term on the soil? And then if you need to get something into the plant immediately, well, within a couple of weeks, doing a chelated iron to start out, but then just doing iron sulfate over the long term?
Yeah. What we can do is kind of a little concerted approach to it. And what we really want to try to limit is the physical contact as best we can of those iron molecules with the bulk of the soil. And so typically when we add, say, around a high-value plant, tree, for instance, or around a shrub or a raspberry hedge or something like that, you can take this coring device that we've talked about for taking soil samples and open up a hole with the coring sampler and fill that then with the iron sulfate material. And some people will mix the iron sulfate 50-50 with elemental sulfur prills. And so as the elemental sulfur over time oxidizes, it produces acid that keeps that a little bit more solubilized within that enriched zone that you've created by filling up that void with the iron sulfate material. So it stays in a zone of enrichment that the roots can then grow towards and into, and it keeps it essentially sequestered away from the bulk of the soil and minimizes how much of that surface reaction is going to take place and the loss over time of those nutrients as insoluble materials. So we do that in several places around the hedge or several places around the drip line of the tree, for instance, or in and around the shrub. You can take in an ornamental planting where you've got a lot of shrubs and flowers and things and trench it around the outside of them and put it down in the trench. And so you're, again, creating a zone of enrichment there that helps to keep that a little bit more available over time. That's just kept away from the bulk of reaction. We broadcast it on the soil. It's going to dissolve pretty quickly, but it's going to begin to interact with the mass of the soil material pretty thoroughly and over short order.
Is this something that you have to dig into the soil, or can you spread it on the top and then have it go into the soil?
It's best if it's incorporated a little bit, because you want to get it down at least to the area where some of the surface feeder roots can grow into that area that you've enriched with the material. It does solubilize and get into the soil over time and will build, the nutrient level. But again, if it has too much time to interact with the surfaces, the matrix of the soil in general, as it does if it's broadcast and just allowed to kind of trickle in and dissolve with the irrigation water and things like that, it'll precipitate into these fairly insoluble compounds pretty quickly. So trying to put it down, incorporate it, or put it in plugs or in trenches or things like that to enrich an area, a zone that the roots can then grow into and towards is a much better approach for that over the long term.
Well, I'm going to talk about raspberries since this is most everyone has raspberries.
Yeah.
So if I want to have a good program of adding iron to the soil for berries, typically what I've done in the past is in the spring before the plants start showing up, and they start showing up fairly early, I have put down chelated iron and kind of scratched it into the soil. I used a big salt shaker and just put it in there and spread it on the ground, kind of scratched it in. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like I probably should be also adding some iron sulfate to have it be more long-term. Scratching that into the soil, is that enough to get it down?
That's a reasonable approach with the chelate. Number one, it's really expensive. You wouldn't want to put it in large quantities into the soil. So getting that on early in the spring, scratching it down in so that you get some incorporation and the roots can actually access it over time. The chelated materials are iron that's kind of bound in a long chain organic molecule that breaks down slowly and releases the iron over time. And so it's a nice slow release mechanism to hold on to that iron. So it's kept away, like we said, from that interaction with the bulk of the soil, chemically. Which helps prolong its availability. And so you've mixed some of that in, which is great. But in terms of long-term and getting it down deeper where more of the root zone can access some of that zone of enrichment, the fact that you've got to do that in fairly high quantity, you want to do that with something like the iron sulfate mixed with the elemental sulfur to help provide for that long-term. And a good soil treatment like that, you know, a little bit of chelate along with the enrichment with iron sulfate can last, you know, 2 to 4 years in a planting, you know, if done in enough areas in and around the raspberry hedge or the tree you want to treat or things like that.
So when you're looking for iron sulfate, does it just say iron sulfate?
Yeah, it'll say iron sulfate or ironite. That is a common brand name of the material, but it'll tell you right on the bag. It's a very common fertilizer material that you can find at any local IFA or garden store, nursery of your choice. And so look for it. I mean, if you ask about it, they'll know right where to go.
And when you say elemental sulfur, you're just looking for something that just says sulfur. That's the yellow stuff.
That's the little
that
yellow
I saw at
Wheat's
Berry
Farm
and that they had put on.
Looks like a half split pea kind of little wafer. You can mix that about 50-50 by weight with the iron sulfate. And as that sulfur oxidizes, it takes about 2 to 3 years to fully oxidize. It produces sulfuric acid, which, as it's produced, will then help solubilize any materials that come in and around it. And that refreeze up some of that iron that may have precipitated over time within that column that you've enriched. And, you know, just you do that fairly regularly, and it's...
Do you do it once a year?
You can with the iron sulfate if you wish. But like I said, a good soil treatment could last 2 to 4 years in an area where you do it like you talked about with a little bit of chelate along with the inorganic zinc.
So it's easy to do when you're getting a raspberry patch established. After it's established, if you don't want to keep moving your raspberry patch, are you just doing it along the edges?
Just along the edges of the hedge there where you get those roots that can grow out then and find that zone of enrichment that you've created.
But the nice thing is I don't have to do that every year.
No.
Like I can do it every two or three years.
Every 3 years or so, and then you'd be in pretty good shape. Now, some folks will say, well, despite the fact that I've treated it, I still see, you know, the classic iron deficiency symptoms. And for those that may not know what that looks like, you've got a leaf that's generally chlorotic across the whole leaf except for the veins, which are very dark green and very obvious.
So the leaf looks yellow.
The leaf looks yellow with very dark green veins. And so you'll look at that and you'll say, well, it's classic iron deficiency. But what happened to that plant is that it was severely winter killed or damaged. And so it's become very inefficient in taking up the iron that may be there in adequate quantities. It's just that the plant itself is suffering from the ability to take it up because of some other external damage.
Would you have to do a foliar spray on those?
You could, but then again, the plant may be suffering to the extent that it's not going to last very long anyway. It might be a cane that, it will survive this year, but probably won't come back next. Yeah. So watch out for that. Unless you see it pretty widespread over the hedge, unless if you see it in isolated locations with individual canes, it's most likely either pest or winter kill damage on that particular cane.
Now, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask, in 90 seconds, can you tell us what the difference is with some of the chelated irons? Because I've been reading the labels, and some of them are only good for up to a certain pH in the
range,
soil.
Yeah.
I'm like, good night. I just spent this much money on this, and it's not going to do me any good.
Yeah.
So I'll have to buy the more expensive stuff, which can be like $80, $90
yeah.
for a 5-pound container.
Yeah, a lot of those chelates aren't stable in our alkaline pHs. They break down too quickly, and so they really don't give that long-term slow-release effect to the release of the iron. So look for the EDDHA form.
EDDHA?
Right.
Okay.
Form instead of the EDTA form.
So the H and not the T.
Yeah, EDDHA. That's the form that's stable in our environment. You'll see it as brand names like Fairy Plus, or if you'll see the number 138.
Sequestrian 138.
Yeah, it's associated. It's associated. 138 is kind of the designation of that particular chemical form.
And that's the more expensive one.
And it can be, depending on where you're getting it.
We can find it. Well, Grant, thanks for coming in.
Great. It's great to be here. Sorry I was a little bit late getting here.
Oh, you're fine. We had a great conversation, so yeah. We'll have you on again. You've been listening to Access Utah. Grant Cardin is USU's Extension Soil Specialist, and he's been our guest for the hour.